Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Good-paying jobs aren't always easy to find in Appalachia. So when news hit last year that pipeline companies were hiring, it seemed like the answer some families desperately were looking for.
It was almost like hitting the lottery when you got that phone call to go work on that job because the money was really good.
But now, as pipeline projects are put on hold, workers are stuck in limbo. And as energy companies begin to use more natural gas and renewable energy, coal-fired power plants in our region are shutting down, leaving many rural communities struggling to try to replace hundreds of jobs.
With the level of jobs that it did provide, you know, people made a good living that worked there. It's a really big thing.
And an increase in natural gas drilling has some landowners worried about possible health risks. So some citizen groups are trying to track whether people who live next to natural gas drilling are more likely to get sick.
I think that this is really us, these small groups, these groups that don't have a lot of resources, doing the work that we know needs to be done. And hopefully the states and or the federal agencies will ultimately pick up the ball that they've dropped.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The economy of Central Appalachia has long revolved around extractive industries, coal, oil, and natural gas. The jobs associated with these industries are often good-paying jobs, even if they aren't consistently available and reliable. But they also can bring environmental and health issues to the region. The fight for jobs is often at odds with the fight to live in a safe and clean place. We've seen this playing out around the coal industry for years, and lately, the natural gas industry has seen a lot of complicated legal and environmental entanglements. Today, we're going to explore how this push and pull is affecting people stuck in the middle of natural gas development, people who just want to earn a living and who are also worried about their health. First, a little history. Did you know that the oil and gas industry in the U.S. got its start here in Appalachia? Some of the first wells on record were here in 1819. Then a few years ago, our region again began to see another natural gas boom. The Marcellus and Utica Shale regions in central and northern Appalachia are producing record amounts of gas, according to the United States Energy Information Administration. While coal is still king at power companies like American Electric Power, EIA expects the amount of electricity generated in the U.S. from natural gas to rise from 34% in 2018 to 37% in 2019. The region's natural gas industry has expanded beyond drilling rigs during the past few years. Multi-billion dollar interstate natural gas pipelines projects are under construction throughout Appalachia. If completed, they'll transport billions of cubic feet of natural gas out of the Appalachian Basin to the East Coast and possibly to export markets beyond U.S. borders. Conservation groups sued several of the pipeline construction companies. In December, a federal court sided with one of the groups, and construction of the 600-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline, or ACP, stopped. Our energy and environment reporter, Brittany Patterson, spent some time visiting with communities directly affected by construction and now by the shutdown. Whether that shutdown is a good or a bad thing, well, depends on who you ask.
When Melissa Wilfong first heard that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was going in the ground just a few miles from the community where she has lived her entire life, she wasn't happy.
At first, my first thought was, oh no, you know, they're going to just tear up everything and be a nuisance.
Hundreds of workers would soon flock to Valley Head, a community of a few hundred people in the shadow of the Allegheny Mountains in Randolph County. But then Wilfong's father suggested the local community center, which the family helps run, should host a welcome dinner. Soon, every Tuesday, hundreds of pipeliners, many from out of state living in campers nearby, began showing up for a home-cooked meal.
This is the community center kitchen. Of course, this is where all the meals were prepared.
Warming dishes are stacked on the counter next to a range and double oven. Wilfong says at times that wasn't even enough space to prepare dinner and dessert.
It gets pretty crowded in here when there's more than two or three people, but we made it work.
Plates were $10, but the pipeline workers often left more. Each dinner brought in $600 to $700, money Wilfong says helped the center, which is largely grant-funded. But it wasn't just about the money. The workers were the first to take up a collection when a community member's home burned down. They bought presents, Christmas dinner, and groceries for two families during the holidays.
You know, we made friends. These people would have done anything for us here, and they're gone.
Construction stopped in December after a federal court ruled that the U.S. Forest Service made a mistake when it gave the Atlantic Coast Pipeline a permit to cross under the Appalachian Trail. Within a few weeks, most of the workers left, and the dinners in Valley Head stopped too. Valley Head is not alone. Along the ACP's 600-mile route, there are dozens of communities like it that were taken by surprise when construction suddenly ground to a halt. Pipeline developer Dominion Energy, which has a majority stake in the project, says it will pay millions of dollars in taxes and create 2,000 construction jobs in West Virginia. And that doesn't take into consideration money spent at local businesses in the five counties through which the pipeline is being constructed in the Mountain State. County budgets are taking a hit. So too are some businesses working with the pipelines.
So we've had some trucks that obviously we idled. We're, you know, busy trying to reemploy them.
Greg Hedges is president of J.F. Allen, a construction company that supplies gravel and builds roads and staging lots the pipeline uses. They invested more than $1 million in four new trucks last year. They haven't laid anyone off, but delayed plans to hire new workers.
We were running 6-12s. We've backed off to more of a 4 or 5 day schedule now.
It takes anywhere from 1 to 3 years to build a large natural gas pipeline like the ACP. It's not a permanent job, but it can be a good one. And some see this build-out of natural gas infrastructure, including pipelines, as the future for the region. On a recent spring day, about 40 union apprentices are sitting in a classroom at the West Virginia Laborers' 170-acre training center in Mineral Wells, West Virginia. Multiple trainings are held here, including a month-long pipeline safety training class and a rigging training. Inside a classroom, the walls are covered in butcher paper with colorful drawings illustrating things like traffic control and how to safely hoist heavy pipeline into the air. During one lesson, students weigh the merits of using different materials to attach pipe to a crane.
The alloy steel chain I don't have here, that's the metal mix.
Corey Dornan is the training supervisor at the center.
It's real unfair to these folks who have trained and prepared themselves for the job for something to shut down that they're relying on with no expectation of, hey, when can I get back to it?
He says union laborers working on pipeline projects like the ACP have at least 160 hours of training before they ever step foot on a job.
When they shut these jobs down, they don't know if they're shutting this job down for a month, 2 months, 6 months, or a year, or indefinitely. So these folks, not only is their livelihood in jeopardy for a little while as far as this job, but they're almost in limbo of, do I go chase this work out of state, or do I wait another 3 weeks? And 3 weeks could turn into 6 months.
Dornan worked for 4 months on a 42-inch natural gas pipeline in eastern Ohio. He says the high wages on these jobs make them extremely desirable.
It was almost like hitting the lottery when you got that phone call to go work on that job because the money was really good.
He's seen colleagues pay off a car or put a chunk toward the house when they get a pipeline job.
Jobs like these really give people a chance.
These are good jobs, but they come at what cost to the environment? Those are the questions environmental groups opposed to the ACP and other pipeline projects are asking, and they're getting some answers using the legal system.
These are extremely risky projects.
Greg Bupert is a lawyer with the Southern Environmental Law Center, one of the groups that has filed lawsuits against the ACP. He says in addition to the risk to the climate posed by fossil fuel infrastructure,
in Appalachia, an impact that I think is often overlooked is it is very difficult to build these projects on steep mountain slopes. There's a risk of explosion.
The Sierra Club is also involved in fighting the pipeline's construction. Kelly Martin directs the Sierra Club's Beyond Dirty Fuels program. She says she understands the frustration directed at environmental groups that have sued pipeline projects like the ACP. But she says the Sierra Club and others got involved because concerned citizens living along pipeline routes asked. And she rejects pipeline developers' arguments that these projects benefit residents.
They're not at all long-term economic benefits for the communities, and yet there is long-term pollution associated with the construction of the pipelines and with the fracking for the gas that feeds them.
She says they've sued these pipeline projects to ensure state and federal agencies are following the law when they issue permits, so those in Appalachia aren't left holding the bag.
The risk here is that communities are left with the cleanup and with the pollution, but without the economic benefit.
Right now, pipeline construction is boosting state tax revenues from the natural gas industry, says Sean O'Leary, a senior policy analyst at the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy.
But we know these projects are going to start winding down in the next year, and when they do, that revenue is going to vanish.
He says broadly, economists have not seen sweeping economic benefits from the natural gas industry at large, despite its sixfold growth during the past decade.
And what we've seen is that the impact that has been there has been very, very narrow, that the growth is really concentrated in the industry itself.
O'Leary says the same is likely true of these pipeline projects.
Once the pipeline is constructed, once the construction is over, it's a pipe, you know, and there's not a whole lot left behind.
According to pipeline developer Dominion, the ACP will require just a few dozen permanent full-time employees once construction is over. Still, the company is confident some workers will be back on the job by the end of the year. In Valley Head, Melissa Wilfong says she can't wait.
They've just done several things for people in the community, and I think, you know, once they come back, they'll continue to do that.
Recently, Dominion asked the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case regarding its U.S. Forest Service permit to cross the Appalachian Trail. It's one of seven permits the project needs before it can fully resume construction. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
So these pipeline projects often hire transient, out-of-state workers. The local company we did hear about that bought more trucks to build roads for pipeline construction, J.F. Allen, is a company based in Buchanan, West Virginia. Natural gas production has increased substantially over the last decade, brought by the advancing of technologies of hydraulic fracturing, commonly known as fracking. Like everything, it comes with a cost. There are stories of light pollution and noise from wells, toxic waste streams, and concerns about gas drilling infringing on landowner property rights, among other things. Julie Grant, a reporter with the Allegheny Front, spent time looking into how the natural gas industry is dividing communities in eastern Ohio. Some want the jobs, while others are concerned for their health and the long-term effects on their air and water. In her reporting, Julie Grant heard from several landowners who say their complaints to the state government have gone unanswered. Here's their story.
Carrie and Jeff Bond's house in the hills of Noble County, Ohio is nearly empty. An antique bed frame, old board games, a power washer are among hundreds of their possessions set outside, ready to be auctioned off. Along with their house and 103-acre farm, Carrie Bond says they need to leave.
It's been difficult, but today, for some reason, I have just this peace because we're finally going to get out of here.
Bond's sister, Jody Carter, tears up waiting for the property where her sister has lived for 40 years to be sold.
This is where we've had all our family gatherings. You know, the kids play in the woods and the pond, and it's just sad. It's sad to lose it all to no control.
The natural gas industry has built up around them in recent years, including a well pad owned by Antero Resources a quarter mile uphill from the house. Antero declined an interview. Four of its lines extract gas from under the property, which means royalty.
Last month's statement was $42,000 is what their royalty check was last month.
But the bonds say the cost for those payments has been too high. The Allegheny Front confirmed that the Bond family made numerous complaints to various state agencies concerning well pad noise and bright lights and pollution. Bond talked about it over the phone.
Every tree in the yard was dying. My cats died. My chickens died, you know. We got sheep dying.
Bond says the family got odd rashes, headaches, dizziness, and her grandson developed a breathing problem. She complained to the Ohio Department of Health, but the health inspector found no health hazard. She complained to the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency.
They came in finally with repeated calling.
The agency declined to comment. Its air testing found leaks at the well pad of benzene and volatile organic compounds and were quickly fixed. But a growing body of evidence shows symptoms similar to the Bonds are associated with gas development.
I really feel like we were let down by everybody in Ohio.
And the Bonds are not alone in their complaints. According to an analysis by the Allegheny Front, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, or ODNR, received more than 2,900 complaints statewide from citizens about the oil and gas industry between 2009 and 2018. Noble County Commissioner Brad Peoples has heard some negatives, but says overall fracking has been good for the local economy.
The oil and gas industry has done more for landowners and more for local businesses in Noble County than anything has in the past 20 years anyway.
A recent industry report finds that fracking companies paid $43 million in property taxes to six eastern Ohio counties between 2011 and 2015.
Yeah, it has been a complete nightmare.
But that doesn't outweigh the problems it's caused for people like Darla McConnell in Jefferson County.
The noise, the dirt, the traffic, the lights, the backup beepers. Because it's so close to my house.
McConnell is one of the 26 people the Allegheny Front interviewed from ODNR's complaint list. They told stories about their water turning orange overnight, about piles of dirt being dumped in farm fields, about sulfur smells and fish kills. Mark Bruce, administrative officer with ODNR, says the agency always responds to citizen complaints.
Sometimes the result may not be what the citizen expected, but we're confident in saying it's only after a thoughtful and thorough examination of the situation at hand.
More than 2,600 oil and gas wells have been drilled in Ohio's shale region since 2010. But longtime environmental attorney Rick Solly, based in Columbus, says Ohio regulations have not kept pace. He says the state is doing more to support the oil and gas industry than to protect citizens.
Coming in after the fact and resoldering a joint that's been leaking carcinogenic gas outside someone's bathroom window isn't the best way to attack a multinational industry.
But the agency's Mark Bruce says its well construction standards are national models. It's also added field staff and new programs in response to the fracking boom.
We're proud of the way our division has grown to oversee the changes experienced in Ohio's oil and gas industry over the last few years.
Final selling price, $1,230,000 plus the 10%.
But Carrie Bond and her family still say the state abandoned them. They auctioned off their house, farm, and mineral rights for more than $1 million and left Ohio. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Julie Grant in Ohio.
That story originally aired on the Allegheny Front, which is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. The story is from a series called Who's Listening, which is supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. In a minute, we'll hear more from Julie's reporting, which looks at how increased natural gas development in Appalachia is impacting landowners, many of whom are caught up in an entangled web of legal disputes. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, some locals in this town sometimes joke that it's a blast to live there. That's because the town grew out of the explosives industry and a factory that helped supply the U.S. Army with gunpowder during World War I. Okay, this week is multiple choice. Is it Dynamo, Kentucky, Boom Boom, Tennessee, Nitro, West Virginia, or TNT, Ohio? We'll have the answer after the break. Your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu. Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia farmers markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome back. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The Appalachian town we explored for this week's What's in a Name has an explosive history, built during World War I. So is it Dynamo, Kentucky, Boom Boom, Tennessee, Nitro, West Virginia, or TNT, Ohio? For the answer and the story behind the name, our associate producer Eric Douglas met up with a man who hails from this town, Ken Thompson.
When I was younger, people would say, "Where are you from?" I'd say, "Well, Nitro." They go, "Nitro?" I said, "Yeah, it was dynamite of a town. We had a blast there."
Today, Ken's a local historian and volunteer at the town's World War I Museum. He says the government established the town in 1917 to manufacture a special kind of gunpowder used during World War I.
A lot of people were under the impression it was nitroglycerin. It was not. It was nitrocellulose. That was added to the other components to make the gunpowder smokeless, so that as you fired your weapon, you didn't have the smoke associated with a gunfire. It was the coldest winter in recorded history in 1917, 1918. And they actually built this town in 11 months. Over 100,000 people actually came through Nitro, whether it was for a job or whether it was just temporary assignment with the military. But over 41 countries were also represented here in this area. We even have a picture of a gentleman by the name of Clark Gable. His dad told him, "Son, go get a job." Well, he was one of those 100,000 that came through Nitro, and he worked as an electrician helping to build some of the Nitro bungalows.
That was Ken Thompson, a volunteer from the Nitro World War I Museum, talking with Eric Douglas about how the town of Nitro got its name. You can learn more about the town and the former manufacturing facilities there, as well as see artifacts from World War I on display at the museum. If you know another story about Nitro or ever heard of another town that you wondered, how the heck do they come up with that name? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Before the break, we heard how the debate surrounding natural gas drilling and pipeline construction is leaving some Appalachian communities in limbo, and some workers who were counting on good-paying jobs had to search for work elsewhere when pipeline projects in the area were held up. On the other hand, many people are concerned about industrial impacts on their air and water and quality of life. They argue that short-term jobs aren't worth the long-term environmental issues associated with natural gas production. And as we'll hear next, some landowners are disappointed in how the justice system manages natural gas development in their community. Like several other states in Appalachia, Ohio has a law that can force landowners to lease their underground mineral rights to energy companies. Julie Grant takes a closer look at what can happen when people try to keep natural gas companies from drilling on their properties.
In 2010, a landman from an energy company knocked on Patrick Hunkler and his wife Jean Bax's door, and it changed their lives.
Well, you know, I didn't know much about fracking.
He offered them $137 an acre for the mineral rights under their 21 acres in Belmont County in eastern Ohio.
That's probably the closest I ever came to signing a lease at $137.
They get 100 calls after that. By 2014, they were being offered $8,500 an acre. Jean Beck says the money might have been nice, but they had heard about water and air pollution from fracking.
No, I would have preferred to not sign a lease.
But still, her husband was open to the idea if the lease protected the air, water, and dark night sky.
That was never addressed. The only thing that they could offer us was money.
Then in 2017, they got a notice from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources called ODNR. Chesapeake Energy was seeking to unitize their property. That meant the state could force the family to sign a lease. Chesapeake declined an interview. Heidi Robertson is a professor of law and environmental studies at Cleveland State University.
We normally think of the rights of the landowner as being things like the right to decide what's done with your land, or what's not done with your land.
But Robertson says that's not necessarily the case in Ohio when it comes to drilling for oil and natural gas. That's because the state adopted what's known as a unitization law in 1965 with requirements for the size and shape of land where a well can be drilled. These are called units, which usually range from 300 to 1,100 acres. Robertson says one unit can have hundreds of different landowners.
Then you have to have the agreement of all of the landowners in order to cobble together the rights to drill.
She says the problem for energy companies like Chesapeake and for people who want to lease their land comes when other landowners in the unit, like Patrick Hunkler and Gene Bax, say no to drilling.
It's almost like a veto, a single landowner being able to veto the ability of all the surrounding landowners to drill.
And to make money from the oil and gas. In Ohio, if a company gets 65% of landowners in a unit to agree to lease their mineral rights, it can use that unitization law to force unwilling landowners into leases. Since 2011, ODNR has approved 144 forced leases or unitizations through hearings in Columbus, like this one.
This hearing before the Ohio Department of Natural Resources.
This is not the Hunkler's case, but it's similar. This time, Ascent Resources has brought a geologist, an engineer, and a landman to testify along with a slew of attorneys. The company engineer testifies that Ascent's project is a $20 million investment. He says without the unleased tracts of land, the company would lose the ability to collect so much gas that the project would no longer be financially viable.
That would be the difference likely in what would be a project that Ascent Resources would pursue versus what we would not pursue.
This is the basis of whether ODNR issues a unitization order and forces holdout landowners to lease with the company, the profitability of the project. At Chesapeake's unitization hearing against his family, Patrick Hunkler asked the state to also consider his environmental concerns. But transcripts of Hunkler's hearing show ODNR told him they had no authority to consider that.
Hey, ODNR, we have concerns about our natural resources. Who can we talk to? They didn't listen to us in the hearing.
But Mark Bruce, administrative officer with ODNR, says the unitization process allows for citizens to comment.
Mineral owners have an opportunity to be heard verbally or in writing during the process, and their comments are always considered.
But the state has never ruled against an energy company in a unitization hearing. Bruce says that's because companies only apply once they've met the state requirements.
The law specifically states that the division must issue an order if the applicant meets the criteria.
Attorney Megan Hunter, who represented the Hunklers, says state law has been changed numerous times in recent years to favor energy companies over holdout landowners.
One side is really well represented, and the government is often aligned with them in these administrative forums, and the citizen is left to fend for themselves.
ODNR did issue orders for Chesapeake to unitize the Hunklers' property, but after constructing the well pad nearby, the company abruptly sold all its Ohio assets, leaving the family wondering what will happen next. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Julie Grant in Ohio.
In the early days of the fracking boom, a sewage treatment plant in Trumbull County, Ohio, made a deal to accept frack waste. Julie Grant looks at what happened when regulators didn't act on clean water violations at that plant and how some of the town's citizens stepped in to fix it.
When fracking took off in eastern Ohio, it helped the struggling rural economy. But Leatra Harper worried that the trade-off would be people's health and the environment.
It weighs on your consciousness, and somebody's got to do something.
She started the Freshwater Accountability Project in response to the natural gas industry. Each fracked well uses millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals. Much of this brine flows back to the surface as waste. Harper heard that a company called Patriot Water Treatment had started working with the city of Warren in eastern Ohio to send frack waste through its sewage treatment plant.
And this is what I always say, my trip down the rabbit hole with the fracking industry.
It started with Tom Angelo, who at the time was director of Warren's sewage plant.
Fracking was something that was of great interest. It had a lot of promise to it.
Angelo says by 2009, the local economy had tanked in the recession, and Patriot's proposal promised $1 million a year in revenue.
So when you're looking at a $2.5 million deficit, you have choices.
The city chose to sign an agreement with Patriot. The company's president declined an interview. Angelo says Patriot would treat the frack waste, most of it from Pennsylvania and West Virginia, to remove heavy metals and other pollutants before sending it to the city sewage plant. From there, it would flow to the Mahoning River. It wasn't long after this when pollutants found in frack wastewater and linked with cancers and birth defects were being found in Pennsylvania's waterways. The state requested that drillers voluntarily stop sending wastewater to treatment plants in Pennsylvania. Leatra Harper wanted Warren, Ohio, to follow their lead.
We took it upon ourselves to appeal directly to Tom Angelo, giving him our concerns that were completely ignored.
At the state level, the Ohio EPA also tried to stop the city from taking frack waste. In 2012, the agency issued a new permit to Warren to discharge from its plant into the river. Environmental attorney Megan Hunter, who was working with Harper, says that permit had a surprise for the city.
Ohio EPA sticks a clause in there saying you can't accept oil and gas waste to the facility. That was Ohio EPA's backhanded way of saying no to Patriot.
The Ohio EPA declined to comment for this story. Warren and Patriot sued the state. Documents from the case show it was unclear whether the Ohio EPA or the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, called ODNR, had responsibility to regulate the flow of frack waste through a public sewage plant. The ruling gave regulatory authority over the frack waste sent to Warren's treatment plant to ODNR, even though ODNR's Mark Bruce says
the division never issued a permit to Patriot.
Bruce declined to say why. Patriot restarted sending its waste to the city plant anyway, and by 2014, when Hunter and Freshwater Accountability Project looked at monitoring records, the Warren City plant was having problems.
And it was all right there. Warren was clearly violating its discharge permit.
Tom Angelo had retired by then. Emails between the new director of Warren's treatment plant and the president of Patriot show the company was sending excessive levels of pollutants to the treatment plants, like lead and copper, and total dissolved solids, which includes salts known to come from frack waste.
He laid out in those emails that that waste from Patriot was so high in TDS, so high in salts, that it was harming their ability to process their own waste.
Hunter says neither the city nor Ohio regulators were stopping Patriot. So Freshwater Accountability Project used a provision in the Clean Water Act that allows citizens to enforce the law.
And that's what we did. We filed a notice of intent to sue.
That was 2017, and within a month, Patriot stopped sending frack waste to Warren. The city settled out of court with the Freshwater Group earlier this year. The city services director declined to comment, but it still irks Tom Angelo.
A government is not in the business of putting business out of business.
But Leatra Harper says frack waste was harming the city's own treatment plant and potentially the drinking water for thousands of people downstream until her lawsuit.
Kind of as a last resort, of course, when all reason fails.
And now the U.S. EPA is shutting down this whole question. As of August 29th, the federal regulator is prohibiting public sewage plants across the country from accepting frack wastewater. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Julie Grant in Ohio.
Ohio residents were able to use the Clean Water Act to counter inaction from state regulators. Another group in Ohio wants to track health impacts associated with gas production. Julie Grant looked into how this group of local citizens is hoping to study the situation before it becomes a problem.
A dozen people are scurrying around a church basement in Youngstown, Ohio. They're arranging tables and chairs, setting up paperwork, and hanging up signs that read Ohio Health Registry.
Well, the Ohio Health Registry is really an attempt to collect the contacts of people who live close enough to any aspect of shale development that they might be affected.
This is Dr. Deborah Cowden, who started this effort. She's a family physician near Dayton and drove 3.5 hours east this morning to organize the registration. Cowden's group created a series of forms that take about 15 minutes to fill out.
This is the medical questionnaire, and I'm going to read some instructions first.
They ask people about their proximity to gas development and about current health symptoms, everything from levels of fatigue, nausea, and asthma, to cancer, mental health, as well as family health history. 60-year-old Martin Sinjenik, a truck driver, filled out the registration forms. He's heard about a new frack waste injection well being permitted near his home.
I live less than a mile from what they're building there, and I'm worried about it.
Sinjenik doesn't think the state is ensuring his drinking water well will be protected from contamination, but he doesn't know how the health registry will help.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It might not do anything. I don't know.
More and more studies have been making connections between living near gas development and the risk of some health problems like headaches and anxiety, low birth weight babies, and even cancer. Cowden wants the health registry to provide data that will help further this kind of research as fracking continues to grow in the state.
If we're going to do this, why are we not attempting to keep track so that we might be able to help people if they have a problem?
Ohio regulators say they do respond to health concerns. Rebecca Fugit is Assistant Chief of the Bureau of Environmental Health and Radiation Protection at the Ohio Department of Health. Fugit says they just don't get many complaints from citizens about the fracking industry.
No, we only get maybe just, it's less than 5 a year. I mean, to be honest, it really is. We don't get very many.
The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which regulates the oil and gas industry, also gets few complaints from people living near these operations. The Allegheny Front analyzed thousands of complaints by citizens to ODNR between 2009 and 2018 and found just 10 reporting headaches, rashes, and breathing problems. But ODNR did get more than 400 complaints about odors. Certain odors can indicate pollutants in the air. Fugit says the health department responds to citizens who think pollution from oil and gas development or anything else is harming their health.
And we work with them on a case-by-case basis to investigate their complaint, to collect environmental data as needed to, you know, respond to their concerns and determine if they have been exposed to any contaminants.
Fugit says Ohio tracks various health statistics, just not specifically in relation to fracking activity. And Pennsylvania and Colorado do have registries for people living near the oil and gas industry to report their health concerns. But some health advocates say they're not doing enough.
I'll tell it like it is. I think it's shameful.
That's Raina Ripple. She runs the Southwestern Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. She wants the government to proactively collect community-wide health data on people in shale gas communities so it can better regulate the industry and protect public health. Her organization started a national health registry for fracking in 2017. An analysis of the first 100 to register found that people living within a quarter mile of gas development were more likely to report coughs, headaches, and anxiety compared with those a mile or more away. But she says this kind of data should be collected in a more systematic way.
I mean, we have to do our best, I'd say, to really fill in the gap. I think that this is really us, these small groups, these groups that don't have a lot of resources, doing the work that we know needs to be done, and hopefully the states and or the federal agencies will ultimately pick up the ball that they've dropped.
Marcellus Drilling News, an industry publication, criticized Ripple's project, writing that it encourages people to blame every headache and cough on gas development.
The medical questionnaire begins by asking about your past health.
Meanwhile, the Ohio group so far has 65 people on its registry and is hoping to reach 200 by the end of the year. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Julie Grant in Ohio.
In this episode, we're exploring some tough questions that don't have simple black and white answers. Are we properly regulating the industry for the protection of the citizens and the land they live in? Even before the natural gas industry took off here in Appalachia, we've dealt with these questions for over a century, as the coal industry has inspired many of the same jobs versus health and environment debates. It's raised concerns over the individual rights of landowners over energy companies. These questions have divided families, communities, and often pitted neighbors against neighbors. Ken Ward reports for the Charleston Gazette-Mail in Charleston, West Virginia. He's been writing about the coal industry his entire career. That work has won him awards, but also drawn disdain from many in the coal industry. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, sat down with Ward to talk about the similarities and differences he sees between the coal and natural gas industries and how those industries are regulated.
What are some of the coming challenges you see for states, not West Virginia and the region, when it comes to regulating natural gas?
What we see
if we pay attention to the history of West Virginia's relationship with the coal industry and apply it to the relationship with the natural gas industry, we see Governor Marland saying, you know, we need to more adequately tax this industry. Otherwise, all of the wealth, all of the riches that are created are going to be hauled someplace else, and we're going to be left with scarred mountains and polluted streams and damaged workers and not have the benefits of all of that economic activity. And I think, you know, we see that now. We see places where coal jobs have vanished or greatly diminished. We see that a lot of these places still don't have good roads. They don't have good schools. You know, a series that Katie Coyne at the Gazette Mail worked on last year showed people in a lot of these places still don't have clean drinking water. Mm-hmm. You know, Jessica Lilly of Public Broadcasting has reported tons of stories about those issues in southern West Virginia.
You've written about the concept of a resource curse. We started with timber and the salt industry, oil and gas actually, and then mainly coal, and now we're back to oil and gas, or back to natural gas specifically. Is that inevitable? Is it? Are we stuck with it?
Well, I don't think it's inevitable. You know, the resource curse is this concept that academics came up that kind of describes the notion that communities that have vast natural resources, whether it's coal or oil, timber, that the fact that they can make a quick buck, essentially, or quick, you know, bunch of jobs off of that discourages other kinds of development. And what I always think of, I think of two things when I try to conceptualize that. And one is a guy that came up to speak at a mountaintop removal public hearing, a guy from Eastern Kentucky someplace who came to a hearing here in Charleston and was concerned that some EPA rule was going to stop mountaintop removal. And, you know, he's a young man. He's like a kid, really. And he said, if you shut down this mining, there's nothing for me. That's the only future I possibly have. What a sad sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, who doesn't want for their kids any possible future they could imagine?
Are there some other places that you can think of that have avoided the resource curse, that they've taken what they've had and exploited it, but at the same time been able to diversify and grow beyond it, that presumably we could use as a model, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think there are places that have transitioned from mining that also have giant tourism industries. And, of course, West Virginia, as you know, has a very vibrant, growing tourism industry. One of the issues that we seem to have difficulty figuring out, though, is the places where that tourism industry and these natural resource extraction industries conflict, and we so often seem to lean on the side of the natural resource industry as opposed to tourism. But one of the things that that unfortunately West Virginia has really fallen short on, and that a number of other states have, is a future fund, some sort of dedicated mineral tax that goes into one big kind of bucket. And earns lots of interest and grows, and smaller portions of it are used to improve the education system, to improve infrastructure for economic development projects. You know, the kind of the poster child for this is the Permanent Fund in Alaska, which gives everybody a check every year. And West Virginia, with the leadership of then Senate President Jeff Kessler, passed a bill creating a future fund that would set aside a certain amount of natural resource taxes for these kinds of projects. The problem is they never funded the fund. They just created the fund, and they never actually they set up all of these little requirements. Well, if the state rainy day fund exceeds this, and if tax collections are X percentage above this, then we'll put some money into it. But they've never actually put any money into it. So we have this future fund with no funds.
They opened a checking account and never made the first deposit?
That's right.
How can a state like West Virginia, that has been focused on extractive industries as long as you or I have been around, her and considerably longer, what can we do better to ensure the long-term benefits for our residents?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is kind of the way we frame things and the way we think about things. And sometimes it feels like West Virginians sometimes we're just so grateful that somebody gave us something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, thank you, Mr. Coal Institute, for coming here and creating these jobs. Well, you know, the coal was here first. And you know, thank you, Mr. Natural Gas Industry. And there's a great push to not – to only tell good stories. You know, we hear this from the governor mm-hmm. all the time. Let's just – why aren't we talking about how awesome we are? And – you know, for the record, I think West Virginia is pretty awesome. I've never lived anywhere else. But we've got a lot of problems too. And I think that kind of the first step really toward a road that gets us in a better place is not being so hesitant to tell the hard truths.
Do you see any positive effects from the natural gas boom? I'm thinking the potential anyway for some of these downstream projects, the cracker plants and that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, we ran a story that with ProPublica a couple of weeks ago about the the natural gas storage hub. And there's a lot of really serious questions about whether that thing's really needed. We ran another story that Cape Michigan wrote about. It's all very sort of secretive about what these downstream plants would be and where would they be and what would the pollution from them be. And I, you know, in to me, that's one of it's a huge mistake being made in not having a robust public discussion about, is this the direction West Virginia should go? I think it's really difficult to know if it's the direction West Virginia mm-hmm. should go when anybody, whether it's a newspaper reporter or an environmental activist or a housewife, anybody who tries to just say, hey, wait a second, let me ask some questions about that, immediately, oh, well, you're just against jobs.
Right.
You're just negative. You're driving people from West Virginia. Well, you know,
you're unpatriotic.
That's right. That's right. I mean, if all of these things, if they're so, you know, fan-dantastic for West Virginia, then they will withstand scrutiny.
That was investigative reporter Ken Ward speaking with our associate producer, Eric Douglas. Ken reports for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. As our economy slowly transitions from coal to natural gas and renewables and state governments work to keep up, the consequences come with human costs. Across the country, electric utilities are phasing out a lot of coal-fired power. In just a little more than a decade, more than 500 coal generators have closed as companies switch to cheaper natural gas and renewable energies. 34 were in the Ohio Valley, in parts of Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky. And more will close in the coming few years. That should mean cleaner air and less CO2 in the atmosphere, but for many communities who depend on the reliable jobs, it comes at a steep price. Brittany Patterson brings us this story about what happened to one community where the local coal-fired electric plant is set to close.
Old brick buildings line the wide sidewalks full of blooming dogwoods of Main Street in downtown Coshocton, Ohio. It's a quaint strip with a barbershop, florist, and photography studio. The railroad runs right through town. But there are also vacant buildings.
We're hurting. You know, there's empty buildings, and that's hard from the standpoint is, you know, I can always say I remember what it was.
Lifelong Coshocton resident Denise Guthrie owns Mercantile on Main, which for 20 years has sold vacuum cleaners and cotton quilting materials. Many of her customers worked in manufacturing or at the local power plant. But in recent years, thousands of jobs have been lost here as major employers like General Electric and a paper mill closed.
So it's like bam, 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 you know, our community is hit.
Now, Coshocton is bracing for another blow. At the end of May, Utility American Electric Power closed two of the three remaining units at a coal-fired power plant in nearby Conesville. The last unit will shut down in May 2020, earlier than expected. At its peak, the plant employed 600 workers. Today, it's about 95. And many who live here, including Guthrie, say that even in a place like Coshocton that has dealt with this before, the coal plant closing is a big loss.
We're resilient. We'll survive. We'll find jobs. Somehow we find jobs. We find new opportunities. But it is a concern.
As the energy sector transitions away from coal, across the country, coal-fired power plants are closing. While good for the climate, it's often an intractable loss for host communities.
And these are huge economic drivers in the regions that they're in.
Ohio University professor Gilbert Michaud studies the impacts of coal plant closures. He says coal plants are often in rural communities, which largely don't have diverse economies, and it's hard to match the pay and taxes provided by coal plants.
Employ hundreds of workers, they have this rippling effect.
In the next 5 years, at least five more coal plants in the Ohio Valley are set to close. That means more than just lost jobs. Just ask Dalton Summers. He's the superintendent of the Riverview Local School District. We chat at Conesville Elementary, where the three smokestacks from the plant have been a fixture on the landscape for more than 60 years.
It was a huge advantage to have a power plant.
Tax revenue supported electives, small class sizes, a swim team. But when the plant is fully closed next year, 10% of Riverview's budget, $2.2 million, will just disappear. To help mitigate that loss, the district is closing one elementary school. But Summers says it's not enough.
A plant like AEP, with the level of jobs that it did provide, the good livings that it, you know, people made a good living that worked there, the tax base to the schools, it's a really big thing.
Officials here recognize Conesville's closing will be tough, and they aren't just sitting idly by. Coshocton's economic development and job retraining agencies are taking steps other communities could learn from.
We have a really strong united front locally as to how we're going to help our community through any type of loss.
Tiffany Swigert runs the Coshocton Port Authority, which does economic development. She's part of a team working to convince new manufacturers to come to the region and provide training to displaced AEP workers. That includes hosting resume and interviewing workshops at the Conesville plant.
Ms. Gibson,
yes.
This is
Joe Eggleston,
here for his interview.
All right.
It's nice to meet you.
Come
at a recent workshop, Conesville employee Joe Eggleston practices something he hasn't had to do in a long time.
So I understand you're here to apply for our open position?
I am.
He's calm, determined to ace even this mock interview, even when his interviewer throws him a curveball.
Here's a random question for you. If you were a tree, any kind of tree, what would you be and why?
I would be an oak, very strong, very sturdy.
Eggleston is confident he'll find a job and hopefully be able to stay in Coshocton. He says it's bittersweet the plant is closing, but for now, he has a few more months of work.
I hope it would last longer, but it is what it is, and we just got to move forward.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Brittany Patterson. Today we've been exploring how an increase in natural gas development has brought challenges and concerns, both for our health and our natural environment. But for some, the jobs and economic benefits that come with this increased activity are welcome, especially as so many jobs have left our region in recent years. Pipeline construction jobs were never expected to be permanent, but when the workers become a part of the community, it's difficult to see those jobs disappear. But haven't we heard this before? What did we learn from our history with the coal, timber, or even salt industries? Are we destined to suffer as we bear the extractive resource cross? In this show, we heard a story that explained when federal laws weren't enforced and therefore didn't protect the people. We also heard Charleston Gazette-Mail reporter Ken Ward say West Virginians have a deep level of gratitude for what we're given. It kind of makes sense that for many of us, we keep simply surviving, trying not to complain or make a fuss. All the while, not thriving. Don't we have a right to thrive? Let me tell you something. Lately throughout Appalachia, I've seen a lot of examples of people standing up for these rights. I've seen teachers, miners, and environmentalists alike. And while it might seem like some of their goals are at odds, I don't think they are. I think we all have a lot more in common and a lot of creative power to make our resources work for our communities.
There's a rich legacy of strong Appalachian community, and when we come together, it's impressive what we've accomplished. Everything from worker safety and rights to emancipation and unity. I think Appalachia still has a lot to teach the rest of the country, too. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the Ohio Valley Resource. Music in today's show was provided by Matt Jackford, Dinosaur Burps, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Glynis Board edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter, too. On our website, you can download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.